from KQED.
This is the California Report podcast. I'm Lily Jamali. Mexico has a new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO.
Reafirmo el compromiso.
I promise once again, I won't lie, I won't grab, I won't betray the Mexican people.
Al pueblo de México.
That's AMLO in his first public speech as president on the balcony of the National Palace overlooking Mexico City's historic square. Governor-elect Gavin Newsom and Attorney General Javier Becerra attended the inauguration, along with Vice President Mike Pence, Ivanka Trump, and other American officials. Emily Green reports from Mexico City.
Festivities aside, Mexico and California are key economic trading partners. And in a sign of just how important that relationship is, Newsom spoke to the press before the inauguration and said he wants to make sure California has an independent relationship with Mexico, regardless of what happens in Washington.
I think you should expect moving forward, particularly with the leadership of the Attorney General and our administration moving in a much more activist approach and engagement with Mexico.
Newsom says one of his primary goals is to set up a trade office in Mexico that would focus on fostering California-Mexico ties.
I think it's long overdue that we invest the time and energy in a permanent basis to make sure that we're represented here in Mexico 24/7, 365 days a year.
For his part, Attorney General Becerra described the relationship between California and Mexico in marital terms.
We're married to each other. I think we both agree that our success is intrinsically tied with Mexico, and Mexico, I think, would say the same thing about California.
For now, one of the biggest concerns is the thousands of Central American migrants camped out in Tijuana, hoping to reach the U.S. Newsom called the situation an ongoing humanitarian crisis and said the five-hour closure of the Tijuana-San Diego border last week after some migrants rushed the area cost the region more than $5 million. He says he hopes that won't happen again. For the California Report, I'm Emily Green in Mexico City.
Also this weekend, on his way back from the G20 summit, President Trump vowed to terminate NAFTA to put pressure on Congress to approve its replacement, signed Friday along with Mexico and Canada. Well, with Democrats taking the House, things could get complicated. Catherine Russ teaches economics at UC Davis. She's also research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why don't we begin with how bad it would be if there were no NAFTA, 1.0 or 2.0, for a period of time while this all gets sorted out?
Well, the Peterson Institute put out a study that said withdrawal from NAFTA would cost close to 200,000 U.S. jobs. More than a tenth of those would be in California, so about 22,000. And they estimate that this would happen pretty soon after withdrawal, so as soon as a year.
What would be the impact on specific commodities if there were no NAFTA for a period of time?
So Canada and Mexico are two of our top five export markets for about $20 billion in agricultural exports from California a year. And we would see tariffs on fruits and vegetables, nuts, go up from 0 to between 17 and 31%, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
I also want to get your reaction to Governor-elect Newsom, who was in Mexico this weekend for AMLO's inauguration, saying he wants to set up a trade office in Mexico. That seems a bit unusual, doesn't it, to have a U.S. state set up such an office in a foreign country?
The legal purview for tariffs really falls to Congress. So Congress has ultimate authority over tariffs, and the president has ultimate authority over negotiating foreign trade agreements. So this does get us into some interesting legal and foreign policy territory. At the same time, I can see why Governor-elect Newsom is concerned, because Mexico is one of our top export destinations. California exports more than $40 billion worth of goods and services to Mexico and Canada. This is about a quarter of all exports from California.
Catherine Russ, Associate Professor of Economics at UC Davis and Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Lily.
And let's go to Sacramento now, where lawmakers are back today for the beginning of a new state legislative session. Housing remains a top priority for Democrats. KQED's Guy Marzorati has more on a proposal to capture millions of local tax dollars to pay for housing.
The idea is called redevelopment, and it existed for decades in California. It works like this. Local governments designate a redevelopment area, and then property tax revenue from new projects there would build housing and infrastructure. But if property taxes are spent in these local zones, they are not available for things like public safety and schools. That's why Governor Jerry Brown, facing a massive budget deficit, pushed to eliminate redevelopment when he took office in 2011.
It's a matter of hard choices. And I come down on the side of those who believe that core functions of government must be funded first.
But when redevelopment went away, so did the roughly $1 billion it created for affordable housing every year. So San Francisco Assemblyman David Chu is leading an effort to restart the program.
Given the intensity of the housing crisis and how big the housing crisis is, we think it is the right time to bring back a new version of redevelopment.
And Chu and fellow Democrats will have a new ally in their push.
We want to bring back redevelopment, not as it used to be, but a new form of redevelopment.
That's Governor-elect Gavin Newsom speaking with KSWB-TV in San Diego. Critics of the old redevelopment agencies said some of the money was spent on wasteful projects. Supporters of Redevelopment 2.0 say that their legislation will require independent audits of the local projects to make sure the money is going to housing and infrastructure. But that's not enough for David Wolf with the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association.
And we really would like to see voters have a say regarding, you know, how their taxpayer dollars are spent and what specific redevelopment projects they're spent on.
The bill will be introduced today as the legislature reconvenes in Sacramento. For the California Report, I'm Guy Marzorati.
We're going to go now to Butte County, where armies of insurance adjusters have flooded in from around the country. They're there to help settle claims filed by survivors of the deadly campfire, which destroyed almost 14,000 homes. KQED's Sonia Hudson reports.
Right now, most people in Butte County are pretty optimistic about their insurance.
They've sent me half of my home value, and now I'm waiting for the fair market value.
The adjuster's been nice.
Should be 100% whatever we were insured for.
That's Donna Caporal, Matt Merlis, and Jim McGee. Things are about to get a lot more complicated for them.
And they think, okay, yes, everything's fine. Insurance is going to be really easy going forward. That's such a tip of the iceberg of really understanding your policy.
Kathy Crowley's home burned down in last October's Tubbs fire in Santa Rosa. She's still going through the claims process, but has been volunteering in Chico.
We are waiting to get a quote from our builder. So until we get the quote, we want 100% know, do we really have all the insurance money we need?
But Butte County is still a long ways away from rebuilding. Insurance adjusters can't even get in to assess many of the destroyed homes because they're still in evacuated areas. For the California Report, I'm Sonia Hudson in Chico.
California lawmakers return to Sacramento today, and like last year, they'll do so with questions about huge, deadly wildfires and PG&E's role in them hanging over their heads. But KQED's Marisa Lagos reports there don't seem to be any easy answers.
When you ask lawmakers most intimately involved in past year's debates over how to prevent the state's largest utility from sparking wildfires, there's one thing most everyone seems to agree on. All options should be on the table.
I'm open. I think when you have a situation where so many lives have been lost, you have to be open to anything that makes sense to improve the situation.
Napa Senator Bill Dodd took on the wildfire issue after the deadly 2017 fires in his district. PG&E equipment started at least 16 of those fires, according to state investigators. State officials haven't determined what caused the campfire in Butte County last month, which killed at least 88 people and destroyed more than 18,000 buildings. But so far, all indications point to PG&E equipment sparking the fire. That's led at least one state senator, Jerry Hill, to push for a conversation about PG&E's very existence.
They're not the only electric utility in the country, but they seem to be the only one that has multiple problems on an ongoing basis, whether it's the rough and ready fire of the 90s, the Butte County fire, the Butte fire of 2015, where two people died. They were fined $8 million for their negligent illegal behavior and activities, the fires of last year's, and now the fires of this year. The common thread in there is PG&E.
Most of the conversation in Sacramento in the past year has focused on protecting PG&E from bankruptcy. But since the campfire, that's changed. The state's top utility regulator, Michael Picker, announced 2 weeks ago that the California Public Utilities Commission will examine the company's corporate governance, structure, and operations in light of the fires. But what could that even mean? No one really seems to know. Californians rely on PG&E's huge grid to deliver their power, and that couldn't change overnight. Here's Senator Bill Dodd.
The idea of breaking PG&E up into multiple units until we understand how the grid operates and make the grid more safe is ridiculous.
PG&E officials told KQED in a statement that there will be, quote, a time and place for discussing this, but that the company is currently focused on restoring service in Butte County. One lawmaker is exploring legislation to let the state issue bonds to help pay for any liability in the campfire, bonds that ratepayers would pay off as a way to protect PG&E's bottom line. The state already passed a bill allowing the utility to pay for damage in the 2017 fires that way. Critics say that's a bailout of a company that may not deserve the help. For the California Report, I'm Marisa Lagos.
Support for the California Report comes from Block Construction, a builder committed to enhancing communities in the Bay Area and Central Coast. BLACH.com. Block Construction. Together, building greatness. The Pacific Auction Company, dedicated to making fundraising auctions successful for 16 years, serving nonprofits, schools, and foundations. Learn more at pacificauctioncompany.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems.
George H.W. Bush's passing on Friday reminded Californians of a certain age of this. The elder President Bush was the last Republican to win our state in a presidential election. 1988 was the year. Republican consultant Mike Madrid joins me now by phone. Mike, great to have you.
Great to be with you.
You know, a Republican presidential candidate winning our state seems truly of another era. How was he perceived here in California at that time?
Well, it truly, in many ways, was of another era. It has been, you know, a good 25 years, at least a generation, since that was possible. I think the question you ask is really a great one, because I do believe that the way California felt about the ex-president politically was not unlike what changed during his tenure. In many ways, you know, George H.W. Bush's election to president was the third term for Ronald Reagan, of course, a native son of California. And he came into the election cycle in 1988 with the wind at his back, with a good economy, with America feeling very good about itself, even though 8 years tends to be a long time for somebody to hold office, for one party to hold power. By the end of the Cold War, the significant transformation in the economy, particularly in California, I think Californians, more than most Americans, were thinking there is no domestic policy agenda. Yes, we've had some successes in the Middle East, but we are really not paying attention to the home front and the economy, and that's where people were really hurting. And then, of course, that was the last time. 1988 was the last time we saw a Republican win the state. 1992 was really the first sign of things to come in the state.
Did you get to meet George H.W. Bush?
I did meet him in 1992, 1991, 1992 were the first campaigns I was doing. So as a young staffer, I actually met him on a couple of his California visits. A very gracious man, very engaging in person. Certainly his personality, I don't think, came out as much on television cameras, but very, very engaging one-on-one. It was obviously very heady for a young staffer in his first forays into the business to be meeting the President of the United States.
Mike Madrid is a Republican consultant and just announced a spring 2019 fellow at USC's Center for the Political Future. Congratulations and thank you, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
And that's the California Report for Monday, December 3rd. I'm Lily Jamali. Have a great day.